Clyde had asked us to bring this bill before the committee. We did not have a quorum, therefore we can't take any action, but we can have public testimony on this, and this is what we'd like to do at this time. I serve on the Finance Committee, and we're going through the Department of Education budget, so I have to go upstairs and send a plan to be mine. I'm going to turn this over to you and get the testimony on record. Hopefully, we'll be able to go back up at the top point.
Danny, why don't you call Fran Ellen to work on that, since she requested this bill? Barbara, are you going to help?
I'm going to just go.
Any of the other ladies?
Sure. Also, sure.
One of you ladies can start, whichever one wishes to go first.
I'm Sharon Andrew, Director of Occupational Licensing in the Department of Commerce. This is an administration bill. I was not involved in its drafting. It evidently has been around for more than a year, so I was not involved in its drafting. However, we do support the bill and its intent. Section 1, which amends the qualifications of professional nurse applicants, is intended to make those qualifications as far as training goes less restrictive. At the present time, the board may only consider licensure whose educational program was taken in American or United States school. We may not consider graduates of foreign schools unless that graduate has been licensed by another United States jurisdiction. We feel that this is more restrictive than is necessary. Not all foreign schools are up to United States standards by any means, and we would not want to reduce those standards. But some foreign countries do have training programs in the allied health fields that are equal to or substantially equivalent to the United States, and we'd like for the board to be able to consider those applicants. Section 2 does the same thing for practical nurse applicants as the Section 1 would do for registered nurses. I'm specifically thinking now of two other nationalities, both England and Canada have some schools which are certainly equivalent to our programs. Section 3 would increase 4 of the fees that are now being paid. And the increases are from one of them $20 to $30, the other 3 from $15 to $25. The examination fee is a one-time only fee paid by the, well, we shouldn't say that. It's one time, it's paid when an examination is taken. If they fail the exam and come back later, they would pay it each time they took the exam. But in general, it's a one-time only fee. The biennial license renewal fee is paid every 2 years. Yeah, we feel that the increases are modest, and in view of the increasing costs of administering all of our licensing laws, that we are in, you know, in line with an attempt to keep us paying our own money. Those are my only comments concerning.
don't mind, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions since you administer licensing in the Department of Commerce.
Yes.
And you do support it, but yet you knew nothing about it.
Well, when I said that I wasn't instrumental, the draft of this bill was already prepared for introduction before the time when I became the director of occupational licensing.
Correct me if my assumption is wrong. Don't we have a board of nurses who do point of view?
Yes, sir.
Could you venture a speculative guess as to why someone other than that board is introducing legislation to change, you know, registration or regulation of nurses when there's a duly constituted board?
Well, I would be reluctant to speak on behalf of my predecessor, but I would say that I would do that, perhaps over the objections of the board, if I felt that it were in the best public interest.
I'm Val Ann, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Department of Health and Social Services, specifically the section of nursing under the Division of Public Health. The existing statute limits licensure at the present time to professional and practical nurses from another, it limits them to nurses from another state or territory. The amendment proposed in this bill permits the Alaska Board of Nursing to consider applicants for a professional practical nursing license outside the state, or this would include from other countries. The department would concur with Sharon Andrews' testimony in that there are other countries who have nurses who are well trained. The impact on the department will not be significant, as in recent years it has been possible to recruit public health nurses within the state or in other states if experienced candidates are not available in Alaska. On the increased fees, this seems equitable in view of the increased cost of living and salaries, and it's not out of line with what's charged to other states. The department supports this change.
Represent the Alaska Nurses Association, and I really don't have anything substantial to add except to lend the Nurses Association support to the bill. I think we view it as pretty much a housekeeping bill, in that I don't believe it was ever the intent of the Board of Nursing or the department previously to exclude foreign nurse graduates from being eligible for licensure. There is a provision in the regulations of the current licensing law that allows the board to give examinations to foreign nurse graduates if they've been previously licensed in their country. But this, I think, speaks pretty much to basic or initial licensure, which the way it statutes quoted now would prohibit those individuals from practicing in the state. We have no objection to the fee increases. I did check with the Department of Commerce several weeks ago to see what revenue was generated from nurses' licensing, including the examinations, and I think it's somewhat over $30,000, which at the current time, which is not enough money to even really support the staff of the Board of Nursing. So I think that this is certainly justified. In some states, we're either fortunate or unfortunate to have large numbers of nurses. You usually end up having money reverting to the general fund in a state from licensing fees, but that's certainly not the case here. And we don't think that any individual nurse would object to the increase.
Barb, do you know if this increase is going to give them enough money yet?
Well, it will. I think it will give the Department of Commerce more well, just I guess the general income will be somewhat greater because of it, and perhaps then the Department of Commerce will feel more justified in asking for increases in the future. For example, I don't think it's realistic in Alaska for any of the boards to be what you call self-supporting because of the smaller numbers of practitioners in each category. So I think the state here for a long time has assumed the burden of public protection by funding, at least in part, the work of these boards and their staff.
Barb, I had one more question. What's the difference in pay scale for your registered nurses and practical nurses?
Roughly, I would say that the licensed practical nurse gets about 75% of what a registered professional nurse would get. That's just it varies, but you could say 2/3 in some parts of the country or here, but I think
it's about
2/3.
Based on that, do you think that the differential in these fees between the two is equitable then? Or maybe $5 spread between the two categories?
I think so. In some ways, I really don't see that there would be that much objection to having the fees the same for both LPNs and RNs, because you are talking about one licensing exam. From an administrative point of view, it probably costs the same to administer an exam to one as to the other, although the LPN licensing exam is not, I don't believe, as lengthy. It perhaps takes as many days. I don't think that's a problem at all.
I guess
that just get along.
You want to join us and we'll vote it out?
I wish I could.
If there's no more, I thank you, ladies. And as Senator Ferguson said, we should have a full committee here. I believe our next meeting is Friday, and we certainly will make some action.
Yep.
Thank you.
Senate Bill number 599, a request for a committee substitute for Senate Bill 599 has been made by Senator Ray, and I understand that Bob, that you can testify on the committee substitute?
Yes, I will.
If you put the chair right up front there.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the substitute bill that you have before you does exactly what was intended in the original bill. The language is probably more clearly expressed than it was in the original bill. And it provides for reading specialists in every school district and has a formula by which additional reading specialists will be made available to the larger districts as they have people involved in the reading program. It comes under the supplemental funding part of the foundation program. The concept has been explored and developed with the Department of Education, and we think that the bill serves a good purpose, will meet some needs, and will not require additional funds for those where they don't have programs. If you have a program, they get funded. They have to show they have a program before they do get funded.
Okay. Are there any questions by the committee members?
Mr. Ray, you know, Senator Ray wanted the substitute and indicated that.
Commissioner Lynn, do you support the committee substitute? I don't know if you've taken a look at it. Here's a copy of it.
Mr. Chairman, I want to indicate that we would be opposed to the original bill as it was presented, and feel that the substitute is a much better way to deal with the problem. We are opposed to any kind of allocation of state dollars under a foundation support program that is tied directly to the hiring of certain teachers. We feel that's the decision of the local school district. But we recognize that in some cases there is a need for some supplemental funds in order to correct some of, or prevent, more importantly, prevent some of the deficiencies that youngsters might have, particularly in the basic skill areas we're talking here, in terms of getting help in the reading and the mathematics and writing areas. So the substitute certainly seems to be much more workable and something that we could support.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions by community members? Is there anyone else here that would like to give testimony on Senate Bill 599? The chair will entertain a motion. Any members that are inclined? How many do you have? Or is there an objection to the bill?
No, I was just trying to start the panel with you.
How many do passes do we have? Thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Lind, is there any other bill that you're here to testify on?
No, Mr. Chair.
Took the testimony on, it was Wednesday when Senator Coletta was here, and I think you can move that one. There was support on all sides.
Okay.
Oh. And we have, can we have Margaret Hall is here too? Margaret Hall?
Is she?
She's Governor of Plains for Regions. And Chris Kirkwood.
We're waiting for a quorum before we start in the room. At this time, we'll take up House Bill 492. And we had testimony on this bill Wednesday. And Senator Coletta took the testimony for us. And we have a recommendation for the committee.
Yeah, it's very basic bill, makes two minor changes. All parties are in agreement. Move it out with due pass recommendation.
Is there any objections? So ordered. At this time, we have Margaret Hall here, who's the appointee to the Board of Regents. And I haven't had the opportunity to formally meet you, but to walk in Juneau. And if you don't mind, we'd like to have you sit up here and have a friendly chat with you. This is Senator Coletta from Anchorage, and Senator Bradley also from Anchorage, and I'm Senator Ferguson from Crosby. Possibly if you could just give us a short rundown. You know, where you're from, and how you feel about the higher education problem, possibly. You may have a few questions.
Yeah, I'm from Alaska. Been here for 27 years. And we came to Alaska, to Wrangell in 1948 and raised six children here. And five of them have either attended or are attending the university at the present time, and the sixth one will be attending in fall. So I have a feeling for the higher education of the state. And I am a school teacher now. And I taught before I was married. I retired from teaching for 25 years and raised a family. I'm back from teaching. And lived in Wrangell, Seward, Ketchikan, and now in Cobo. My husband's an Episcopal clergyman. State, we had worked with the Wrangell Institute when we were there from 1948 to 1958. Seward at the time that Alaska Methodist University was in the formulating stages and had a little part in that and have urged and supported in every way that we could for education in the state because we felt very strong and I felt very strong. Tremendous need for post-secondary education in the state. Would
you like us to do that
served on the American Lung Association Board for 5-6 years, and we're in the past president of that group and have contact with many people throughout the state. The present time I'm on the board of the Baptist Mission, which is home for children from the area on Kodiak and throughout the state.
Are there any questions? What's that?
That's a brief rundown.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, I would have some. Mrs. Hall, why do you wish to serve?
Why do I wish to serve? Because I feel that I have something to offer.
And I ask, just a brief overview.
All right, I feel as a teacher, I have a training in education which will serve to well, looking toward the academics of the university, I feel strongly on that point. And looking at the courses that are offered and on the education committees that the board has, I really do know something about it.
I might ask one more. There's an effort that sorts no small consequence at the present time. I'd be curious about you committed yourself as to, off the top of your head, philosophical position. I didn't feel the separation between colleges from universities.
Well,
not having studied, I've studied the bill and I've studied as much as I have been able to see on it. And just from my own point of view, I feel like it's a duplication of services that would be offered and a duplication of administration. And I feel that with the new academic plan that has just come out, really hasn't had a chance to get itself off the ground and try new rural education. Vice presidency, which has just been established, that these things should be given an opportunity to be tried within this present setup, and that right now a fracturing of that system would, to my way of thinking, would create two boards instead of one, and two administrative setups instead of one, and also I've just seen within the last 20 years in my own home state, which I came from a long time ago, the total turnover from having had this type of system of separation, going to a unified system, which they find is working much better than the University of Minnesota, with its several state teachers' colleges and state normal schools, which came under the, are now all branches of the University of Minnesota.
The term I was thinking of was a couple of things. I'm also interested. And another issue is, you know, at least I think that's important. And that's the possibility of elimination of private education in secondary schools. I mean, you did specifically. I know you stated that you learned some medical school degree and it's developed.
That's a hard one to answer. I feel that it does if it is private. But Alaska Methodist University really, I don't feel can call itself a totally private institution. And I still feel that it's important to have the competition.
Yeah.
But is it a private institution? I think it needs a lot of study to find out whether it really is a private institution.
Do you have any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In regard to the last Methodist University call, are they supposed to have divorced themselves from any denominational or theological connections, or is the last Methodist University has no association with the church? Is that what you meant by being private?
No, by private I mean supported, not by students.
All of your experience has been in the teaching area at this time?
In my profession? Yes.
It seems that in the past, people who have been abreast of what the Board of Regents does more so than I in many years, elderly people, people interested in education, involved in it, have said that they need people who have some, you know, accounting ability, fiscal, financial skills, because that's a big thing. It takes about 5 years or so to really find out what's going on. Do you have any talents in those areas at all?
No, but I'm willing to study, and I have studied, and I went over the budget with some people who were knowledgeable in this sort of thing, and I feel tried very hard to get an understanding of budgetary problems. I have worked on the budget for the, as I say, the American Lung Association, which is a very small organization compared to the university, but does have a financial obligation to use the public funds. And in a small way, I have had a part in budgeting money to be used. And I feel that we do have some people on the board who are experts in this field, and that there needs to be a broadening of themselves.
The reason I ask that is because that's one of our greatest expenditures in the state, you know, is the university get larger every day. There have been a lot of accusations made by many people, even myself, about the lack of planning and administrative ability, financial ability of the university officials. A lot of professors, but I think it's a business. We give some money to support readers, but we don't check. I don't have any other questions just now.
No, I don't have any more.
Yeah, I'd like to get back to community college. Would you care to, I'm going to voice an opinion as to why you feel came out with dissatisfaction within the university structure from such a group of enforcement community colleges.
I really don't know. I can't answer that without further study of it myself. I have read all of the things that have come out, but I don't find the answers in the things that I've read.
One more, Mr. Chairman. This is an assumptive question, but based on all you've read, which is about the same thing I think, just what I've read, as a breach of the debt, there hasn't been sufficient activity in the endorsement of community colleges to prompt you to investigate why this condition exists and why it's not supposed to be so pointed. That group
I think it calls for a complete investigation. I think it calls for us to look very strongly at what we have set up as an academic plan and a plan for action and find out what has prompted this. But as I said before, I also think that the plan that has come out is just off the ground, and I think that it deserves some trial. My own opinion is that this should not be rushed into.
Mr. Chairman, would you consider the next schedule of meetings of the regions of the region, which are called item 6? And of course, we have a bill before us now to do that very thing. I believe you have a meeting. I think this issue is sufficient enough that as a new member on there, you would request a special meeting from the 26th to address the results of this problem.
That's a hard one to answer. I think it's a very important issue. I would like to discuss it with any members of the board.
I'd like to say on behalf of the committee, we appreciate your taking the time to come down here and meet with us, and we're sure that we're going to have it. So we're going to see you around, you know, for a number of years on the other regions, and we appreciate you again for taking the time to come and meet.
Well, thank you. It was nice to meet all of you. You've been names in a committee before, and now your faces. It's important.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Cook is also here, and he wanted to talk about this. The bill. So why don't we take Senate Bill 658, now over there. Senate Bill 658. Sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 658 at this time. Have you come over and give your name for the record and the position that you have. Testimony that you about to give us.
Should I wait for Fred or just go ahead?
You just start right up.
Okay, I'm Kerry Romsberg and I am director of the Post-Secondary Education Commission. The commission has not had a chance to really study Senate Bill 658 because it has come up after our last commission meeting. We have discussed at length another bill that you have before you, which is House Bill 144. Our position, however, with Senate Bill 658, after my participation in these meetings in terms of participant in the audience, and also the inputs that we have received from the various members of the faculty and the administration of the university system, have pretty well brought the commission to the point that we feel that since this bill is such a drastic departure from what has been done in the past, and since that one of the principal reasons and justifications for this bill, aside from the distress and disruption that it appears, is the McLean report, the commission feels that the issue should be tabled and studied at great depth. And by studied, I mean a feasibility study to look at the possibility of splitting off community colleges, to look at the ramifications of such a move and the costs involved. The McLean study is a survey and is not a feasibility study. I'm sure that Steve McLean would agree with that statement. As a matter of fact, I've talked to him about it. They would not report that their study was a feasibility study. They didn't go into any of that type of depth. I feel that if this is really to be considered, that such a study should be done. And to conduct such a study would take about a year. And what I would propose is that the commission, as a neutral body within the state system, be charged with the administration of a feasibility study and appropriate funding be allocated to the commission to conduct such a study. Now, that type of a feasibility study we've looked at, and we would estimate that the cost to the state would be about $45,000. That would include the travel around the state and bringing in a few people that have expertise in community colleges from other areas and other states. One of the things that we've heard quite often is that Alaska is the envy of every other state in terms of our higher education system. I don't dispute that statement, but I don't accept it either, just as a blanket statement. We have a lot of correspondence from other states that have other types of systems that they seem to be quite enamored with. I think it would behoove the state to at least listen to all parties, and if we can, rely on the experience in what has happened in the other states. So that's really our position in this whole matter. We haven't studied it. We would request an opportunity to study it, and we would hope that the state would take the time to really do an in-depth, detailed feasibility study before they took such action.
Okay, are there any questions?
Yeah, more.
Yes.
Gary Black, would it be possible to have your suggestion to do two things, to find out why these people wish to remove themselves?
I suspect that we could include that in it. I would imagine we'll have plenty of input as to why they want to be split out. I'm sure you're getting plenty of input also. Now, if you're talking about the justification behind their desires to split out, that's something very subtle and something quite different. I agree with what Mrs. Hall said before. That's an issue that I think would take a different kind of study, and that's not a feasibility. That's something aside from a feasibility study. That's one that we would accept a charge to. I would be more reluctant to get into that type of study because of the difficulty of really trying to come up with meaningful results.
Is that the end of your testimony?
That's it.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's
seems that when we, as we said, we anticipated last year when we raised the income level to the $300 level, that we'd have a great number of people applying, but that was not true. It may well be that the Alaska Longevity Bonus has had an impact on this end of the scale also, and it would keep people from applying for programs.
Yeah. And you're probably well aware that there is no additional federal matching money available.
And it impacts across the program, and it impacts not only the assistance payment program, but it impacts the Medicaid program and the general medical program as well as the, so it impacts across the board in the division budgets.
Are there any questions by committee members?
No, Mr. Chairman. I didn't know this was coming up today. I would have talked to you about it. But I've talked to everybody from the top to the bottom about this.
I understand that. We have one
other
person that's going to testify on this before you make your determination.
Okay.
Marcia, could you bring up the... We need one more chair here. If you'd explain your findings on this bill, I'd appreciate it. Too.
Well, when we reviewed the department's original fiscal note, we found essentially a number of errors and proceeded to build what we presumed would be a new budget for the bill as proposed. In addition to that, we tried to review the situation of those on assistance and those who may now need assistance as a result of the increased cost of living in the last year. As you remember, last year we increased the assistance level from 250 to 300. Basically, Alaskan recipients are now at 300. The U.S. average is $202. The state of Washington has 194. The national range runs from about 154 to 300, Alaska being the highest. That makes Alaska's need standard about 48% above the national average and 54% above Washington's average. I think the thing to bear in mind, of course, is that we've had a severe cost of living increase as representative of the consumer price index in Anchorage. Now being 11.93, as opposed to the Social Security COLA, where their estimated cost of living increase of 6.7. We had developed a proposal for increasing the assistance level based on that to an increase based to reflect that increased cost of living for food in Alaska. But we're going into the conclusion of this discussion. Debbie Stacks can describe our original analysis of the bill as proposed.
Okay, I think you all have these black notebooks in your folder.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have green, some people have black. Okay. The first folder is a section by section analysis of the bill as it stands now, and you can certainly read that at your leisure. I think probably what we're most interested in right now is looking at the analysis of the fiscal note, which is the third tab back. The original fiscal note, I have to say that there are differences between the amended one and the original one. I just got a chance to review it 2 minutes ago. So some of the comments that apply to the first fiscal note certainly don't apply to the second one. Some of the problems that I noted with the first one is that originally when the department was doing the fiscal note, they didn't take an account for a cost of living adjustment for 77 through 78 as the original. As the statute amended last year, it states that there will be a cost of living increase. I notice I have not had a chance, an opportunity to check their figures, but there is mention of a cost of living increase there. So that comment on the first fiscal note will not apply. I had problems with their original caseload figures because they took a high caseload figures instead of taking an average through the year. And I adjusted accordingly by working on averages rather than taking a high point. The third comment that I had was that they had included in the original submission 680 nursing home patients. That seemed a bit high to me because at the present time there's only 350 adult assistance recipients in public nursing homes. not counting the 35 and Harvard U and API. So it seemed a little bit too high for me, and that would have an impact on the bill. The other thing was I had some problems in that they assumed that everyone who was receiving grants would be getting Medicaid assistance. And Medicaid is a medical program, so consequently, by that assumption, you're assuming everyone will get sick during the year, and also that everyone will choose to use Medicaid when many of Alaskans, people on public assistance have two resources, Alaskan Mental Health Service as well as Medicaid, and they would have their free choice of provider. The third thing that I had some problems with was assuming that everyone who's on public assistance will use general relief medical. And that's even more restrictive than Medicaid, because if you have a prior resource, it's currently a last pay resource. So if your resource, so if you have a resource that is a better quality than what's on general relief medical, then you would have problems getting coverage for your drugs on general relief medical. This would, right now, as policy is generally being interpreted, would eliminate a lot of the recipients due to their resources with Native Health and other, perhaps, Champus, other prior health resources. The other thing I had a problem with was a 20% inflation rate on drugs. The budget submission right now includes a 15% inflation on drugs. This fiscal note includes a 20%. There's a difference of 5%. And if we have better information, then possibly even their drug submission for their FY17 budget should be adjusted accordingly. These were problems that I had. So when I went through, and if you go to budget based on history, I took some of the things that I had some problems with and tried to draft around it. So if you go to budget based on history, it says chart one. Go past the graphics. Okay. What I did is I went through, this is the cost, the bill right now includes a retroactive payment to people who have been on the rolls during FY76. And I worked through and took what were actuals in some cases are percentage, because it's really hard to figure out how many people are on nursing homes at any given time. And I worked out the cost by the number of recipients times the average cost per month, and I came to a 1.8 cost for the $1.8 million for the retroactive coverage, which is very similar to the department's of 1.7. Okay. If you want to turn on to the second page, this is the cost for 77. Okay, and their new fiscal note has the cost for 77 at 3.2. My costs are at 2.4. And I can tell you what the basic difference is. When I worked out projections, I came out with the total number of eligibles, and it came very close to their 300. Except I looked at historical experience, and basing it with census figures, and found out that a significant portion of the people who are eligible for the program do not choose to use it at this time for any number of resources. They could be right now living with their children, don't prefer to go on these types of programs. Also, I'm dealing with census figures, so that there are some problems with it. So the department's 300 caseload figure is a fair figure, but it is looking at 100% utilization, which I had some problems with in dealing with their history. So what I did was I took through the costs for what these new recipients would be as a chart A, and the current recipients under the program who would be entitled to additional benefits as well with the raising of the ceiling to 355. And if you notice on the federal funds, these are all just from Medicaid, because everything else has to come entirely out of state funds. Your cash assistance is out of state funds and your general aid. But the big difference is in the area of the projected number of eligibles. And I have included on the first part of the description, which you can read at your leisure, that this is based on a historical trend. So if something happens in the future that's different from what happens in the past, such as a disaster in Nome or an economic depression that we haven't seen in the past, these figures would probably be inadequate, the dollar amounts to what total need is. But this is based on history. In the past, the legislature has deemed to put legislative intent on these VRUs, stating that if supplemental was needed, it would be considered only to pay for legally obligated debts for these people, so that they wouldn't be, so that their lifestyles wouldn't be hurt by unforeseen conditions that you wouldn't want to be. I can go through this entirely if you'd like on all the way through Medicaid and explaining how I do my projection.
What I'd like to do, if possible, is let us have these records, and I believe Gina's going back tonight or something. Wednesday, we'll bring this back up, and that'll give us some time to look through this and better understand. We can just receive it today. So. Can you just briefly give us the difference between what your projected budget is compared to the...
The last section of the bill, the description, budget for last McCullough. Essentially, we took a couple of things into account. We started with a premise that the retroactive payment was extremely costly and that we probably could not get it through the Finance Committee, and tried to look at the existing standard that would be in effect as of January 1 of this year, which is $300. We then looked at other legislation which is affecting the lifestyle of these people. The Alaska Longevity Bonus Bill will presumably pass and will provide an additional $25 per month for elderly recipients. About two-thirds of the people who are on old age assistance are also on ALB. So their payment levels will be $325. That payment level does not include the blind or the disabled. To reflect the problems that these people incurred because of the cost of living, we chose to use the Anchorage Consumer Price Index, which would raise the payment by $13.29. The automatic cost of living increase that we've already put in the bill last year, put in the statute, will increase the payment level by $20. So on July 1st, there'll be an automatic increase to $320 plus the ALB, which will be $25. So the needs standard will be $300. Essentially, the cash payment these people are eligible for as of July 1st will be $345. But the disabled and the blind will be at $320. We felt that if you wanted to increase the COLA, to increase the actual amount of money to go to each recipient, regardless of whether they were on ALB, that you could include the 4.4% CPI, and that would be $13.29. You could have a maximum payment of $333.39 effective July 1st. The cost of that is $663,000. Federal funds are
going to cost the same amount. Where are you
having the federal funds? Federal funds are Medicaid. There's no federal assistance to increase the needs down, the actual cash payment to the recipient. Based on?
There's case that increased
cost. I mean, your federal money on the increased cost.
No, there's no federal monies which will come in as a result of passing along the federal increase.
Oh, well, you mentioned the figure $79,000 federal money from Medicaid.
You mentioned.
That's what I mentioned.
But the COLA, of course, itself doesn't earn any. You don't even get additional federal matching with you because of the bigger case load because it's COLA. But the COLA is going to increase case load.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Debbie, will you continue working these things out? Were you aware that House Bill 2525 back in Congress has started to move to its conclusion?
Is that the one that...
That would require that we would pay for all Medicaid services rendered to Alaska Natives and Native Americans, Native hospitals.
If they were...
most of our recipients who are eligible are out in those areas.
There is on each of the folders, I believe I've put in there about the legislative intent, so that you'll have it catching for historical.
When we built it, we were trying to protect it.
Well, yeah, you're dealing with 100% utilization.
That's right.
In the discussion issues, in the first section, we discussed the future state Medicaid reimbursement. It does not specifically address the problems raised in the 100% coverage for under Medicaid for people who are presently receiving assistance in the health service.
It would be an unforeseen, just something that has not happened in history, and the whole budget would have to be.
Sure will, yeah.
It wouldn't be the passage of this
about 4
bill.
Million. No, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that that is something that's looming on the horizon here.
Do you have the language for a committee substitute to address the problem?
No, we don't.
How would the committee feel if we had committee substitute drafted up and then address that instead of the original bill? Say one.
I would. That's what I tended to talk to you about. Today has been one of those days. Didn't get a chance to.
That would be the substitute based upon including the Anchorage price index.
Right. And if you'd have the bill drafted up for us and have it down here, if you can by Wednesday. Okay. And I have a finance meeting right now, so if the committee wants to continue preparing this, you can. I don't know what I have to do.
Right.
Did you want to keep going there?
Why don't we wait for the substitute?
Okay, and then we'll go over this at the same time.
I've talked to everybody from the governor down the last night, except substitute the activity. Obviously, they've done a lot of work.
If the administration could possibly go through and take in mind the committee substitute to address the problems or the information that we brought up there. By the Legislative Affairs Agency, and be ready Wednesday if possible. I don't know whether we'll be able to go back in time, but we should not. But looking at them, and we'll bring the bill back up for discussion then. And I would like to know the administration's feelings at that time on the committee substitute. If there's no other business before us, we'll adjourn. If there's no objection. Thank you for taking the time to come in.